When we come to a Beis HaKnesses, we have an obligation to be respectful and mindful of the space that we are in. Where does that come from? The Pasuk in Sefer Vayikra, Eshabsosai Tishmoru Umikdashi Tiro Ani Hashem. We have an obligation that we should have Mora HaMikdash, which obviously means a reference to the Beis HaMikdash itself. And how does that trickle down to a Beis HaKnesses? So we know the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah, Ve'ahi lahem lemikdash ma'at. We have a pasuk in the Navi Yecheskel that refers to a Beis HaKnesses as a mikdash ma'at. And therefore, from there we learn that the same way we have a mitzvah of Mora HaMikdash, that we have to be mindful of the Beis HaMikdash when we are there, and there's a certain kind of behavior that we're allowed or not allowed to have there, so too when we come to a Beis HaKnesses, we should also have a certain mode of conduct and communication and behavior in the confines of the Beis HaKnesses itself. Now it so happens, the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos, that what defines the permissible behavior in a Beis HaMikdash is not necessarily the same than what defines the behavior in a Beis HaKnesses, which is for another time. It's just interesting to note. Let's say we know, in a Beis HaMikdash you're not allowed to wear your shoes. We don't all come to shul in the morning and take our shoes off. Obviously, it's not what we do. So why is that a discrepancy? Interesting question. It says in the Beis HaMikdash, you're not allowed to bring your wallet into the Beis HaMikdash when you go to do Aliyah L'Regel. We know that we come to shul and we do bring a wallet. We give out tzedakah. So we bring wallets into shul. So the rules are not exactly the same, but the general concept is one that is learned from the Beis HaMikdash and it trickles down to the Beis HaKnesses. A fascinating insight that Rav Asher Weiss pointed out to me a number of years ago. I think he said he found it in one of the Svarim of Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz. I challenge you to go find it in the tiny little print, hundreds of pages. I've never found it. But he said that he had a hint to this in one of the Svarim of Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz. And that is, perhaps, a Beis HaKnesses was an institution that was only brought about after the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And that is a fascinating insight. The only time that we find in the Nevi'im a mention of Beis HaKnesses is after Churban Beis HaMikdash. How can that be? Well, it makes a lot of sense. Because why do we have to come to a Beis HaKnesses? Why can't everybody daven in their own homes? Because we know that we need to have a minyan together to daven. Since when do we need to have a minyan? Is there a pasuk in Chumash that says when you daven, it needs to be together with a minyan? No. The pasuk does say, v'nikdashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael, when you have Jews together, it's obviously a Kiddush Hashem. But nowhere does it say that you need to daven per se with a minyan. Where did that idea come from? Well, we know that there's such a concept of Dvar Mishra B'Kedusha. You have Kaddish Kedusha Baruch Hu that cannot be said b'yechidus. In order to have an allowance to say Kaddish Kedusha Baruch Hu, you have to have a minyan present. That started by the Anshei Knesset Gedola. When did they live? After the Churban Beis HaMikdash. So he said, the genius of the Anshei Knesset Gedola was, you used to have a focal point for the entire Jewish people, that was the Beis HaMikdash. That kept everyone together. Shalosh Pamim Bashana, everyone came, everybody remembered, everybody knew, this is where I belong, this is where I really have my focus. Then came Churban Beis HaMikdash. And the Chachamim were concerned, what's going to be? You're going to have fragmented communities all over the world. Nothing's going to pull them together. Imagine if you didn't have a need for a minyan, Jews wouldn't live near each other. Everybody would choose to live wherever they want. And there would not be a Jewish community. Chachamim came along and instituted Dvarim Shebekdusha. And they said, we have to say Kaddish Kedusha Baruch Hu. By doing so, they ensured the continuity of Jewish communities for all eternity. That was the most ingenious thing for them to do. And that is why we don't find a mention of a Beis HaKnesses anywhere before the days of Churban Beis HaMikdash. I think that's an amazing insight, a historical insight, but I think it probably sounds very close to the truth. I think it sounds right. Nowhere do we find an indication, and it makes a lot of sense why we don't. That is his suggestion, and he said that it comes from Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz. Yeah? So it says that they used to go to a separate room because there was so much going on. It's true. The Mishnah does say that they used to go in the Beis HaMikdash off to a private room to daven. I think that's because, imagine, you have blood all over the floor. The way the Mishnah describes the scene in the Beis HaMikdash, there was blood all over the place. There were animals being brought in and out, people roaming around. So they went to the side room to daven because why would you daven here? But I don't think it says that they did that for a minyan per se. So this is, I think, a very fascinating insight. Anyway, as part of this idea of Mikdashi Tiro, as part of this concept of Beis HaMikdash that then trickles down to a Beis HaKnesses, there's a certain behavior that is expected in a Beis HaKnesses. And if you look here, the Gemara Maseches Megillah Daf Chav Ches tells us, Tana Rabbanan, Batei Knesios, Einogim Bahem Kalas Rosh, in a Beis HaKnesses, one has to behave a certain way, you're not allowed to have Kalas Rosh, Ein ochlim bahem, ve'ein shosim bahem. You're not allowed to eat in a shul. You're not allowed to drink in a shul. Ve'ein ne'usim bahem, ve'ein metaylim bahem. You cannot just do frivolous things in a shul. You can't just walk around in a shul. Somebody actually asked me a fascinating shayla about the back sukkah plaza here. So that used to just be an empty space. Now during COVID, they made it into a shul. But many people who live behind the shul this way or park their cars there, it's much easier and more convenient for them to walk straight through there to get to their car instead of walking out the front of the building and going to the back. Now, I know the security probably doesn't want us to do that because all these gates are alarmed, and when you go out, it makes noise. But, okay, talking about people who maybe are not doing the right thing, so they want to just take the shortcut through the back. So people ask me, that's a nice thing to do, but now that we've built the back, and Asher, it's good you're here. Now that you built the back, thank you very much, again, a year and a half later, it's look what it's done for us, such a Kiddush Hashem. So now that we have the back that's turned into a Beis HaKnesses, does that now follow the rules of a Beis HaKnesses? It says that in a shul, you're not allowed to use it as a shortcut from one place to another. So for example, if I am in the background here, and I want to get to the front lobby there, I would not be allowed to walk through the Beis HaKnesses as my shortcut. That's disrespectful to a shul. I have to go around in the lobby. So now that we have the outside designated as a shul, is that also considered Kedushas Beis HaKnesses, that a person would not be allowed to walk through? Do you say, no, the bottom line is it's not really a shul. Bottom line is the outside was used in the interim period. It continues to be used because people want to be COVID conscious. But the bottom line is it's outside. And maybe the rules of a Beis HaKnesses would not technically apply there. Interesting thing to think about. I'm not exactly sure. I would feel strange saying that it's not after all the minyanim that we've had there and all the Dvarim Shebekdusha and all the Barchus and the Kaddush and the Kriyas HaTorahs and everything out there. I would say that it would be a little strange for that to just revert back to be nothing. But I'm not sure. It's an interesting question, just something to think about. But this is what the Gemara says. There's a certain behavior that is expected of all of us when we come to a Beis HaKnesses. Now this idea of being Mechabed a Beis HaKnesses, is that a Din D'Oraisa? Is that a Din D'Rabbanan? After all, it seems to be learned from the Pasuk of Umikdashi Tiro. And some Rishonim take that very seriously. The Uraim is of the opinion. The Uraim has a Sefer HaMitzvahs where he counts what are the 613 mitzvahs, which is an interesting question in the first place. The Ramban writes in his commentary to the Sefer HaMitzvahs, the first comment that he has is, who said that the number 613 is accurate? Who said that there is a magical number of 613? Maybe there are 500 mitzvahs, maybe there are 800 mitzvahs. So the Ramban first proves that 613 is the number that we're looking for. Once you get to that, so now all the Rishonim debate, how do you calculate the number? How do you really know what counts as a mitzvah and what doesn't? But the Uraim is famously of the opinion that one of the 613 mitzvahs is Kavod Beis HaKnesses. How do we know that? From the Pasuk Mikdashi Tiro. And the other Rishonim disagree. If you look here, the Ran writes in number 5, that is not true. The Ran says, Hitilu wa chachamim kedusha midivrayim. Says the Ran, while it's true that we have an idea that you should be Mechabed Beis HaKnesses, that is only a din de rabbanan. After all, the whole Beis HaKnesses is only a rabbinic institution. So how can you say midaraisa you have to be mechabed Beis HaKnesses if it was never around? So that's the opinion of the Ran. Seems to be the opinion of many others as well. And that is the machlokes harishonim. Now the Stechemet writes, if you believe that the Uraim is correct that there's a din de araisa of kavod Beis HaKnesses, then he said the chora it should follow that the same way we have a mitzvah of asuli migdash v'shachanti b'socham, we have a migdash, we have a mitzvah to build a Beis HaMigdash. So too, he says, we have a mitzvah to build a shul. Now we know the Shulchan Aruch says there are certain institutions that every community must have in order to define itself as a Jewish community. So every community needs to have a mikveh, and every community needs to have a school, and every community needs to have a shul. And everybody needs to contribute to that enterprise of the community. So for example, we need a mikveh in the town. There is no mikveh. We're not talking about that we have a mikveh and you just don't like it. There's no mikveh in this town. How can you have a Jewish community without a mikveh? So we need to build a mikveh. What if I say, I'm already 80 years old, my wife doesn't need a mikveh anymore, so I'm not going to pay for it. Let the younger people pay. Says the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't work that way. If you signed up to be a member of this community, the same way that all of us have to pay taxes, even though my child may not be in the public school system, and maybe I don't use the library, and maybe I don't use the garbage man because I drop off the garbage on my own, we all have to pay taxes, so too, you have to pay Jewish taxes. Jewish taxes are, there are certain things that are staples of every Jewish community that you cannot get around. Doesn't matter how old or how young you are, how much you use it, how much you don't. We assume everybody needs to share in the expense of these certain staples of every Jewish community. And a Beis HaKnesses is one of them. Even if I say, no, I'm fine davening at home, doesn't bother me. No, everyone has to contribute toward the Beis HaKnesses, which I think is interesting. Now again, if you have a community with 10 different shuls, then no shul can say, you have to pay for my shul, because he can say, this is fine. We have a community with more than enough options, so nobody can force you. This is talking about a situation where you don't have a shul, or the shul is not providing the service that everybody needs it to at all. Then you say, we force people to pay, because that is something that a community cannot live without. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes something that I think is very interesting. I was just in Australia last week. I just came back yesterday. And one of the, I spoke many, many, many times every single day, like 5 or 6 times a day for 10 days straight. And one of the opportunities that I had to meet with people there was they got together a group of parents who have special needs children. And what I was most happy about was that for many of them, this was the first time that they ever met each other. There were only 35 families there. It's a very small pool of people who need these services because the whole community is not so big. But I would have thought that at least the support group would have been created years ago. If you have 35 families, at least they should all be there for each other. Many of them never met each other. And I said, my being here or not, doesn't matter. But the fact that all of them finally met and now sat down, after I left, I was told that they all stayed for 2.5 hours just to schmooze and to talk about different things. And one of the things that I brought up in that discussion was a very modern conversation that many of the great poskim have. And that is, when we have a need for a special needs institution for those in the community who have special needs children, who's supposed to pay for that? So this is discussed by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in the Igros Moshe, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and Rabbi Yashiv. So why is this something that's been brought up only in the last 50 years? Because 50 years ago, special needs kids were locked away in a house. Nobody paid attention to them. Families were ashamed and embarrassed to even let anybody know what was wrong with their child. And there was no opportunity for the kid at all. So I said, it's a bracha in itself. The fact that this is even discussed in the modern day tshuva svarim, it shows how much we have advanced in the area of special needs, of special education. The fact that this has gotten to a point where it's even worthy of a discussion of who should pay for it means we have advanced 1,000 steps forward, that there's even such a discussion to be had. So now the question is, now that we have to build a special needs institution, who should pay for it? Some say the parents who need it should have to pay. We're such a small population of parents who need it. How can they possibly pay for it? Okay, so go and fundraise. It's your problem. Adam Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein all give their own reasons why they disagree with that logic. Comes from a different source, each one of them. But they all come to the conclusion that no, this needs to be a shared proposition by the entire community, whether one has a child who needs those services or one does not. You have to share in that responsibility. You have to share in that obligation. Why? So they write, the same way every community, the Shulchan Aruch says, needs a Beis HaKnesses, needs a mikveh, needs a police force, needs all these different things, and I need to contribute even if I don't think it's important. So for example, I got a gun license. I didn't, but I got a gun license. I have guns in my house. I'm not afraid. Someone's going to break in. I don't care. I'll take out my gun. I'll be fine. I don't need the police. Defund the police. Does that mean I no longer should pay for the local police force? Of course I should. Why? Because very nice that you have a gun and you feel safe, but the rest of the community is not going to function without a police force. And all of these things are a communal responsibility, a communal obligation. So too, right, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rabbi Yashiv, as well as Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, we share the obligation to educate and to give opportunity to special needs individuals as well. Just because you may not need those services, you're no different than the woman who's 90 years old and doesn't need the mikveh, but also has to pay for it, because we need it for the Jewish community. So I think that is a very fascinating discussion. Again, the details of how they got to that conclusion are fascinating in and of itself. Why it is that we have that obligation is interesting, but the bottom line is the same, and that is that we have to build certain things. So the bottom line here that's relevant to us is, the Yerayim writes, I know we're getting off track here, but the Yerayim writes that the obligation of Kavod Beis HaKnesses is a mitzvah midaraisa, mikdashi tiro. Based on that, the Stechemet writes, we should say, the same way we have a mitzvah of binyan beis hamikdash, vasuli mikdash, so too we should have an obligation of binyan beis HaKnesses. We have to build a shul. And it's not only because every community needs a shul and we have to just do that for the betterment of the community. It's more than that. It's because the Torah says we have a mitzvah of asuli mikdash, of building a beis hamikdash, and that would follow that in our days we have an obligation of building a beis HaKnesses. This idea is something that we find in many different contexts in Shulchan Aruch. That a shul, even the way it's constructed, in many ways the way it's designed is patterned off of a Beis HaKnesses. Just a few things that came to mind today were the following. Number one, the Tosefta writes in Maseches Megillah that when you build a shul, the Pischei Beis HaKnesses, the opening of the shul, should be Litzad Mizrach. Now, it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes the way a shul is configured, it's not always going to work out that it's going to be facing that way. But the bottom line is, the way the Tosefta says it is, it's supposed to be Keneged HaMizrach. Why? Because the way the Heichal was, the way the Heichal in the Beis HaMikdash was also Pischo Keneged HaMizrach. And therefore, we should try to pattern it off of that. The Ramah writes that we should have the Bima centered in the middle of the shul. Why does the Ramah care if we have the Bima in the back of the shul? What does he care if it's in the front of the shul? What's the difference? No, it should be in the middle. So the Rambam says, for practical purposes, why do we have a Bima? In order to read from the Sefer Torah. Well, if you're going to have the Bima all the way in the back, the people in the front aren't going to hear. You're going to have the Bima all the way in the front, people in the back aren't going to hear. So we put it in the middle. So the Rambam is just giving practical advice, and that is, keep the Bima in the middle. This way, everybody will be able to hear the Kriyas HaTorah and be Yotze the Mitzvah of laning from the Sefer Torah on Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos. Okay, that's what he says. However, the Chassam Sofer, as we know, was a major advocate of the traditional Jews in Europe at the time. There was a very strong wave of Reform Judaism that was really picking up steam. And one of the things that they did was they moved the Bima from the middle of the shul to the front of the shul. And that was something that the Chassam Sofer was very offended by, because he said, this is the beginning of the end of Orthodoxy. Why? Because if we're going to change that, it's going to lead to other things that are going to change, and we're going to break down everything. Now, I wouldn't have chosen that as an example, that the whole religion is going to fall apart because we move a Bima. But the Chassam Sofer saw that as part of a larger trend. And therefore, the Chassam Sofer writes that when the Ramah says that we have to put the Bima in the middle of the shul, it's not simply because convenience purposes that we want everyone to hear, and practically this is just the best way to do it. The Chassam Sofer says, no, we do it this way because in the Beis HaMikdash, the Mizbeach was in the middle of the room. And we had people walking all around the Mizbeach to offer karbanos. If you would have had it all the way against the wall in the front, who would have been it? That would not have been convenient for anyone. And therefore, he says, the same way the Beis HaMikdash has a Mizbeach in the middle, so too the Bima serves as the Mizbeach, and that is why it should be in the middle of the Beis HaKnesses as well. Now, the Chassam Sofer goes so far as to say, any shul that doesn't have the Bima in the middle, you're not allowed to daven it. So Rav Moshe tones it down. He says, okay, take it easy, everyone. Maybe in the 1800s, when he was fighting against the Reform, he had to make such a statement because anyone who's going even a part of this movement, you're going to lose your children, and who knows what's going to happen to them. Obviously, Rav Moshe says that's not the reality today, and there are many shuls that have the Bima configured a little bit differently, whatever, for whatever reason. And he says, l'chatchila, if I was asked to shayla where the Bima should be, I would say you should follow the Rama in the middle. If you happen to come to a shul where the Bima is going to be situated differently, I don't say you should daven outside and walk out and protest. You should daven there, it's okay, as long as it's not a Reform synagogue. But he says if it's an Orthodox shul and they happen to have it differently, that would be okay. The Shulchan Aruch also says in Uchas Beis HaKnesses that we light candles in a shul. Why do we light candles in a shul? Explains the Mishnah Berurah, Shekein HaYosem HaMikdash, because that is what they did in the Beis HaMikdash. Just this week, somebody asked me a shayla, and that is, he wants to dedicate in a shul a... He wants to dedicate a very fancy Aron Kodesh in a shul that they're building. It's under construction now. And he said that as part of the Aron HaKodesh, he wants to dedicate something that is not going to have a paroches on the front. He wants to have some designer come in and have the wood, whatever, some kind of beautiful thing. He's going to put gold on top of it. Really nice. So he asked me, is there any objection? I know that every shul in the world has a paroches, but he said, maybe that's just because the paroches is nice. What if I'm making something that's 100 times nicer than a paroches? And I'm paying 100 times more than a paroches. So would that be something that is permissible or not? I told him, it's interesting you ask. Rabbi Avadi Yosef actually has this exact shayla. In the Tshuva Sichave Das, I think it's in the 6th Chelek. I was in Australia at the time. I couldn't look it up. I didn't have any of my svarim, but I think it's in the last Chelek of the Yichave Das. He has a Tshuva where he discusses this very shayla. And he says, there was somebody who wanted to build a golden Aron HaKodesh. And he said, if you're going to put a paroches on the front, that's going to take away from the beauty of the Aron HaKodesh. So, are we allowed to bypass the minhag of having a paroches, or maybe there really is no minhag? Maybe the only reason we do it is just that it should look nice. But if I'm making it look nice otherwise, maybe that would be something that would be allowed. Rabbi Avadi writes that no, aside from the fact that it looks nice, again, sometimes you go to a shul and the paroches is not so nice, but aside from the fact that a paroches is very nice, usually, he says you're not supposed to do it. Why? Because we know there's a pasuk in describing the construction of the Mishkan, we're told that we have a paroches lahavdil ben hakodesh uven kodesh hakadashim. That we have to make a separation between that which is kodesh and that which is kodesh kadashim. We don't want people going into the kodesh hakadashim. How do we make that demarcation? We're going to put a parochas there. So he says, based off of the Binyan Beis HaMikdash, that is what we have today. The whole Beis HaKnesses has a level of sanctity. Obviously, the Aron HaKodesh is even more holy. Why? Because it houses the Sifrei Torah, which is the hallmark of what a Beis HaKnesses is all about. And therefore, he argues that even though you have good intention and you want to build a beautiful Aron Kodesh, we assume that you have to put a parochas there because it's supposed to be patterned off of the Beis HaMikdash and the way that was done.
Is that the outside? Would that be within, you
know, so it could be in the inside. Some people do that on the inside. I've seen that.
So I'm saying
yeah, so I don't know if it's going to work with his thing, but I told him to look in that tshuva. I think it's there, and this is actually an interesting discussion. Just parenthetically, while we're there, at some point we'll get back. The good news is, we always finish in time for the Bechina. So no one has to worry. We'll get there. So there's a comment there of Soloveitchik made, which I've always found very interesting. He says, the original parochas that was in the Beis HaMikdash, why do we have it? Lahavdil, to make a separation, Bein Kodesh, to the Kodesh HaKadosh. So it was to separate between that which was holy, the outer area, the outer section of the Beis HaMikdash where everybody was, and to the Holy of Holies, which is only available to the Kohen Gadol alone on Yom Kippur. Okay. So Rav Soloveitchik said, normally when you think about Havdalah, you think about the fact that I have something that's holy, and I have something that is profane, and I have to make a separation between that which is holy and that which is profane. And he said, but when you look in Chumash and you talk about Havdalah, Havdalah doesn't just mean learning how to discern between that which is holy and that which is profane. That's easy. Learning how to discern between that which is Kodesh and that which is Kodesh Kadashim is much harder. You go and you say, everything looks great, everything looks beautiful, it's all holy, it's all sanctified. No. Soloveitchik said it's important to know the difference between this and that. You have to understand. And I think about it often. Soloveitchik said, when we say Havdalah every Matzah Shabbos, so we say a few Lashonos of Havdalah. We say, Hamavdeh ben Kodesh l'chol, ben Or l'choshech, ben Yisrael l'amin. What's the difference between Or l'choshech? It's very glaringly obvious. You go outside, you can see. Is it light outside? Is it dark outside? Is it night? Is it day? If you travel across the other side of the world, you may get confused. But generally, you can see where you're up to in the day. It's Or and Choshech. What's the difference between Kodesh and Chol? Not so easy. That's not any discernible distinction that I can make. You have to feel it. You have to know. The difference between Kodesh and Chol is something that is elusive. It's something that it's hard to realize. You have to know that there is a difference there. So what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want of the Jewish people when he says, Bein Yisrael la'amin? Does he want the distinction between Klal Yisrael and the Umas Olam to be one of Kodesh L'chol? Should be, you know, we should all be wearing the same clothing, we should be going to the same jobs, we should be traveling on the same subway, and we should be doing everything the same as everyone else, and just those who know, know. Or does he want the Jewish people to be like the difference between Aron Choshech? That anyone who sees you the moment they interact with you, they know right away, this is a Jew, this is how the Jew behaves. What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want from us? And if Soloveitchik took this theme, you know, to an extreme, and he said, basically, you have to realize the Gemara does talk about it. The Gemara has a discussion, what is more Kodesh? Sefer Torah, Tefillin Shel Yad, Tefillin Shel Rosh, this, that, different levels of Kedusha, Malam HaKodesh Olam Aridin. What if the Sefer Torah gets ruined? Can I cut out a piece of it to use for a Tefillin? What if a mezuzah gets ruined? Can I use it for a Tefillin? This, all the different calculations. So they just said, what's the difference? It's all considered Torah Shemachzav. It's all written by a Sofer, the Kedusha V'Tahara. It's all considered to be holy. You see from the Gemara? No. There is a difference between mezuzah, and Tefillin Shel Yad, and Tefillin Shel Rosh, and a Sefer Torah, and it makes a difference. Because it's important in life to see the distinction not only between Kodesh and Chol, but also the difference between different levels and gradations of Kedusha. So Rav Soloveitchik said as well, it's important to know different people in the world who have positions of leadership, it's important to know who is a Gadol B'Yisrael and who is just Yeshua Rabbi, right? So it's very nice that you interact with Yeshua Rabbi all the time. The bottom line is, don't fool yourself to believe that that is on the same level as somebody who's a real major Talmud Chacham. It's not the same at all. Obviously, they serve different roles, they do different things, but we cannot conflate them. Both of them are Kodesh. Both of them are very important, and both of them serve vital and integral parts in our lives. But one is Kodesh, and one is Kodesh Kadashim. One is on one level, and one is on a different, and that is very interesting. But all of that comes from that pasuk where we're told, Lahavdil men HaKodesh, uvein HaKodesh HaKadashim. Either way, the Gemara tells us that davening in a Beis HaKnesses is something that is considered to be extremely important. And the Gemara in Brachas Davav writes, Minayin, how do you know? Shakodesh Baruch Hu Matzei BeBeis HaKnesses. How do you know that the Ribono Shel Olam can be found in a Beis HaKnesses? Shenemar, Elokim Nitzav Ba'adas Kel. The Gemara there writes in the first line as well, Ein Tfilo Shel Adam Nishmas, Ela BeBeis HaKnesses. Your tefillah will be answered if you daven in a Beis HaKnesses. The Yerushalmi writes as well in Brachas that we should try our best to go to a Beis HaKnesses. That is where we belong. And therefore, the Shulchan Aruch even goes further to say, look at number 8. Shulchan Aruch says, what if a person has to be mispala b'yechidus for whatever reason? I can't daven with a minion, or there is no minion in the town. Af al piken yispala b'Beis HaKnesses. If you have to daven b'yechidus, you should do it in the Beis HaKnesses. You shouldn't do it at home. Why? Because there's something unique, there's something very special to the Kedusha that is encompassed in a Beis HaKnesses itself, and therefore he says we should do whatever we can to make our way to the shul. The Mishnah Berurah adds as well that somebody who comes to shul will have the opportunity to have an Arichas Yamim. That is on the bottom of the page, number Lamed Tes, where he says, V'chalam mashkim umar of the Beis HaKnesses, zoche la'arichas yamim, shenemar ashrei adam shomeali lishkor al dalsosa yom yom. So a Beis HaKnesses means not somebody's home. Davening in a basement is not davening in a Beis HaKnesses. A Beis HaKnesses is to daven in the shul, not only because Barovam Hadras Melech, which is obviously a very important value, but on top of that is the fact that the Shechina is Shruya in the Beis HaKnesses. The Magen Avram actually picks up on something that the Shulchan Aruch writes. Shulchan Aruch says, if you look on here, the Shulchan Aruch says in number Yud Aleph, Misha Yesh Lo Beis HaKnesses Be'iro, this is Simon Tzadi in Shulchan Aruch, Si'if Yud Aleph. Somebody who has a shul, ve'eno nichnas bo lehispalel, and he chooses not to go to the shul. What does that mean? He chooses not to go to the shul. Doesn't say he doesn't daven. He is davening. Just chooses not to come to shul. Nikra shachin ra. He's considered a bad neighbor. We don't want such people in the community. That's what it says. V'gorim galus lo lebana. Very severe punishment that the Shulchan Aruch writes here, quoting in Gemara. Then he continues. Mitzvah larutz kisheholech lebeis haknesses. When we come to a shul, we should try to walk as quickly as possible. We should show an enthusiasm, we should show an excitement to go and meet HaKadosh Baruch Hu and have the opportunity to converse with the Ribono Shel Olam. How do we know that? Because the Gemara quotes a pasuk, "Bebeis Elokim Nahalech Beragesh," that we're going to approach HaKadosh Baruch Hu with great simcha, with great joy. Now writes the Magen Avraham, although it's true that we should walk as quickly as we can to the Beis HaKnesses, once you come to shul, you shouldn't be all out of breath and you shouldn't be roaming around the shul. You should walk in be'ema uviyiro v'nachas. He says, once you come to shul, you have to be in a relaxed mood in order that you should have the opportunity to daven properly. And the Gemara then goes further and says, while it's true that a person should run to shul, and when they're in shul, they should relax, but when shul is over, you should make sure not to run out. Why? Because, like the Rashi says on Chumash, kitino kabarech mibeis ha-sefer. You don't want to look like that little child is running out. Now, of course, people have to make the train, they need to go to work, they need to leave whenever they need to leave, and that's okay. But the way in which we go about leaving the shul is something that should be with a certain perspective, with a certain kind of mindset, and never should it look as if we are trying to run away from the opportunity to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a Beis HaKnesses. The first relevant and very important issue that we need to discuss regarding a Beis HaKnesses is this idea of eating in a shul. So what do we do about eating in a shul? I'm just going to introduce it now. I see it's already almost time to end the shiur. So we're going to continue next week with this very important topic, but let's begin like this. The Gemara says in the Yerushalmi and Sanhedrin, the Yerushalmi says that when they used to be Mekadesh the Chodesh, when the Beis Din used to come together, so they would all have a Suda after they were finished. And they did that Suda in a Beis HaKnesses. That's what the Yerushalmi says. Well, why'd they do it in a shul? Presumably they didn't have a separate room where the Beis Din would sit. They didn't have money for a separate Beis Din location. The Beis Din sat in the local shtibel, the local shul. After they were finished being Mekadosh the Chodesh, being Me'abed the Shana, everyone sat down and made a L'chaim, and they all had some Kiddush, and they made a Sudas Rosh Chodesh. Very nice. So much so, that the Yerushalmi himself has a suffix, do I need to do Bedikas Chametz in a shul? And the Yerushalmi asks, why would I have to do Bedikas Chametz in a shul? Who's ever going to eat in the shul? Who would ever dare to eat in the shul? Yerushalmi says, no, because once a month, when the Beis Din comes together to be Mekadosh the Chodesh, to be Me'abed the Shana, a couple times a year, when they have these get-togethers, so people are eating, and therefore we have to do Bedikas Chametz before Pesach, because maybe it turns out that some Chametz got stuck there. Based on that, the Shulchan Aruch says in Simen Kuf Nun Aleph, that Silchas Beis HaKnesses, that one is allowed to eat a Sudas Mitzvah in a shul. The same way the Beis Din, after they were Mekadosh the Chodesh, all sat down to have a Sudas Mitzvah together, so too, if we have a Sudas Mitzvah, the Shulchan Aruch says, that would be permissible. Along comes the Magen Avraham, and he says, slow down, not so fast. Why? Because after all, we know that when they had the Sudas Rosh Chodesh, who was there? It was the Dayanim of the Beis Din. That was a very serious crowd that was there. They were all very serious people. And what do you think they ate already? He says they didn't sit down to a single malt scotch, and they didn't sit down to have all these charcuterie boards and everything else. They didn't have carving stations. They sat down to a shtickle, you know, a little, I don't know, a little piece of bread. They dipped it into olives, he writes. What else were they eating? That was it. So he says a suda like that, with very serious people, eating almost nothing, of course we could do it in a shul. That's a sudas mitzvah. But he says, the Magen Avraham, you're going to take upon yourself, you're going to have a kiddush in the shul. Who knows who's going to come? Who knows how people are going to behave? Who knows how they're going to eat? Who knows what they're going to talk about? You're going to have everybody coming, converging onto a Beis HaKnesses to have a kiddush in the shul? Right, said Magen Avraham, no such thing, can't be. Now I'm going to leave off with a question. We know that we obviously don't follow that Magen Avraham. Right? We know we have kiddush all the time. And we have many opportunities where we come to a shul. Many times there's a bris in a shul. Many times there's shalosh shudas in a shul. So you have all these kinds of things that we do in a Beis HaKnesses, and never does anyone bat an eyelash. So how do you explain that? So Mirtz Hashem, next week we're going to have to follow up with that. Explain how the Achronim get to that. If after all the Gemara seems very clear, you're not allowed to eat in a shul. It seems that there's a dispensation for a sudas mitzvah. Does that mean everything? Is everything considered a sudas mitzvah? What mitzvah is there? And when somebody has yard set and they serve some schnapps in the back of the shul, is that what's the Indian there? What's that all about? Is it really a mitzvah? Is it something that's warranted? Is it something that maybe we shouldn't be doing? That and a lot more, Emirat Hashem, next week. Okay, have a good night, everyone.